Welcome to China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson, along with Sarah Williams.
The United States portrays the ASEAN meeting as a setback for China.
China struggles to expand the construction of earthquake-proof buildings.
Tibetans in exile reach out to Chinese citizens in a new push for autonomy.
Our roundtable looks at China-Japan tensions on the anniversary of the announcement of Tokyo's surrender in World War II.
And China welcomes a set of panda triplets. Hello and welcome to China Focus.
Let's look at some of the biggest news stories of the week.
Territorial tensions in the South China Sea were highlighted during a meeting in Myanmar last weekend of foreign ministers from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. The United States is portraying the outcome of the talks as a setback for Beijing's attempts to minimize the disputes in the contested waters.
VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok reports.
There is no specific mention of China in the final statement by the meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, although the group and its meetings in Myanmar's capital did consider a freeze on provocative acts in the South China Sea. That was proposed by Washington and Manila. Despite China's rebuff of the proposal, U.S. officials are characterizing the outcome of the overall meeting as a positive one. Secretary of State John Kerry told reporters in Naypyidaw that during all of the relevant talks, he underscored the need for a binding code of conduct in the South China Sea.
There is positive language that came out in the communique issued by ASEAN foreign ministers yesterday as a result of that discussion that embraces this idea of resolving these issues in a thoughtful and peaceful way.
Although talks have been held on a code of conduct for the sea, there has been little significant progress. China has criticized involvement by the United States in the South China Sea issue, contending Washington is encouraging such countries as the Philippines and Vietnam to be more assertive as part of America's military pivot back to Asia. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, who met with Kerry for half an hour on Saturday, told reporters at the ASEAN gathering that it is premature to move towards settling the territorial dispute based on international law, saying China is being provoked by other countries. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Meanwhile, Chinese state media accuse the United States of inflaming tensions in the South China Sea. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
Both China and the United States have lodged accusations over actions in the South China Sea, which is contested by China and several other Asian nations. China's state-run People's Daily newspaper said the United States was emboldening its Asian neighbors in claims to the waterway, which is rich in natural resources and one of the busiest shipping routes in Asia. The People's Daily said the U.S. position is making the Philippines confident of winning the South China Sea dispute. Xiaohe Chang, a professor of international relations at Renmin University, says the South China Sea dispute is testing relations between China and the United States.
That's the bad signs of China and the United States relations, particularly when two countries try hard to build the so-called new type of major powers, major countries relations. And the rhetoric in Washington and Beijing against each other has heated up.
This week, the United States accused China of fomenting instability in Asia through its aggressive actions and proposed a voluntary freeze on provocations in the region. The U.S. State Department says it is calling for a de-escalation of tensions and the timely negotiation of a meaningful code of conduct for countries' actions in the South China Sea. China and ASEAN have been working on a code of conduct for more than a decade. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Earlier this month, a powerful earthquake in southwest China killed more than 600 people and destroyed an estimated 22,500 homes.
The tragedy highlights the difficulties China faces in extending safety standards for homes in remote parts of the country. Rebecca Valley reports from Hong Kong for VOA.
According to the China Earthquake Administration, most of the homes in the mountainous area of Yunnan where the quake hit were made of bricks, wood, and mud walls. They were too old and weak to resist an earthquake, the agency said in a statement. As a result, the overwhelming majority of those killed in last week's 6.1 magnitude earthquake died under collapsed houses. Longan Shen is a professor at the Sichuan University's Institute of Disaster Management and Reconstruction. He says that in recent years, previous earthquakes in Wenchuan or the one in Yan'an definitely had an impact on those areas, and their awareness on anti-seismic construction has improved. But because of the economic conditions, many of the buildings in rural areas still lack in anti-seismic capacity. China upgraded its anti-seismic standards and offers subsidies to residents of quake-prone areas to build sturdier homes. But residents told the newspaper the subsidies they received were not enough to buy material, transport it to their village, and pay a contractor's fees. The government has said it plans to extend anti-seismic standards to all buildings in China by 2020. There are still enormous challenges for that goal to be realized in the countryside. Rebecca Valli reporting for VOA News in Hong Kong.
This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the summer summit in the Silicon Valley in California. A zoo in southern China says recently born panda triplets could be the only set of its kind to survive. Guangzhou Zoo officials say all three panda babies and the mother, Zhu Xiao, are in good health following the July 29th delivery.
Well, Sarah, we know that pandas have an extremely high infant mortality rate, but generally they survive if they're still healthy 15 days after they're born. The zoo said it does not expect to publicly display the panda triplets for another 4 to 5 months.
Pictures released earlier this month showed the pink-skinned pandas, whose eyes had not yet opened, inside of an incubator. The panda baby's gender will likely not be known for about a month and will not be given names until a later date.
About 1,600 pandas currently live in the wild in southwest China, with more than 300 others cared for in captivity.
A mother murmurs in twilight sleep to drive away despair.
Today is August 15th. It marks the 69th anniversary of the surrender of Japan to the Allied powers in World War II. Japan agreed to an unconditional surrender after the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the Soviet invasion of Manchuria.
The events then continue to impact a range of present-day tensions between Beijing and Tokyo. We speak with two experts, Rana Mitter, professor of the history and politics of modern China at Oxford University. He's the author of the recent book, Forgotten Ally, China's War with Japan, 1937 to 1945.
We're also joined by Mark Selden, senior research associate in the East Asia program at Cornell University, professor emeritus at Binghamton University. He's the author of many books and the co-editor of the book War and State Terrorism, The United States, Japan, and the Asia Pacific in the Long 20th Century.
We begin by asking Professor Selden to describe the state of Japan as it agreed to surrender.
Well, I wasn't there, but I have had accounts from many who were, including my late wife. And many people in the know, had, of course, understood that Japan was sinking fast over the preceding months, but many others did not. They heard the emperor for the first time on the radio. He had never spoken to the Japanese people before, and he spoke in a kind of stilted, distant, archaic language that was crafted for him, but he gave the message of surrender. So many were in shock, but many others, especially those who had been following the war closely and knew what was happening, were beginning to look forward to an alternative to the wartime repression and the wartime disasters that Japan had gone through. Those disasters, we sometimes forget in the United States, were not just the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They were the firebombing of 64 Japanese cities, utter destruction of virtually the entire urban landscape of Japan, with the exception of those that were being reserved for the atomic bomb. So there was shock, and for some, there was some hope.
Well, Professor Mitter, in your book, China's War with Japan, 1937 to 1945, You describe how hard the war was for China, especially with Japan's invasion of the country. I realize you were not in China at the time, but what were the conditions like that you know of in August 1945 after that such long and brutal struggle?
Indeed. Well, like Professor Selden, I wasn't there at the time, but again, like him, I've spoken to several people who were, of course, there. They're now, of course, elderly, but at the time they were children or very young men and women. And they recall a situation which in some ways is very parallel to that of Japan, because by August 1945, China was a devastated country. It's often forgotten in the West, but of course, China was actually the first Allied country to enter what we call World War II. Of course, it wasn't World War II in 1937 when the fighting broke out between China and Japan. It seemed more like a more local war in Asia. But over the course of the following 8 years, China continued to resist, and there were at least two major forces that did that. The Chinese nationalists, of course, were the recognized government of China under their then leader, Chiang Kai-shek, but also the Chinese communists. And Mao Zedong, probably the most famous Chinese leader of the 20th century, really came to prominence during the wartime years. But when you get to August 1945, you're talking about a country that is pretty much at breaking point. China was devastated by horrifying price inflation. So people were almost literally carrying wheelbarrows full of banknotes to pay for their bills because the value of money had been essentially sucked away. And also the Japanese invasion had, of course, created huge numbers of atrocities in China. Some of the most famous in the early years of the war included the notorious Rape of Nanking. The Chinese capital city of Nanjing was, of course, invaded and treated extremely brutally by the Japanese armies in the early years of the war. By 1945, the Chinese armies had been fighting for the best part of 8 years, and they were pretty devastated. The soldiers who were left were often starving to death. The government had become very, very incompetent, very corrupt by that stage. In a sense, it was a miracle that it kept fighting at that point. But certainly China, to most Westerners who observed it in August 1945, was a country almost on the verge of collapse. If the war hadn't ended in August 1945, who knows if China could have actually continued fighting for another 1 or 2 years, as people expected it would have to if the atomic bombs had not dropped on Japan.
Rana, I'd like to jump in on 2 points suggested by what you're saying that I think are important. In the American consciousness of this war, this was basically a war between Japan and the United States, and we often forget not only the tremendous sacrifices of the Chinese, but their crucial role in tying down Japan over that eight-year period. And so I think it's really important for us as we rethink the meaning of the war, and of course the meaning of what followed later, convoluted as it was, is to place on the table not only the sacrifice probably of more than 10 million Chinese. The figures remain controversial. We have no official figures. 10 to 20 million Chinese arguably died as a result of the war. But the crucial role that China played in what was eventually the Allied victory as well. So I think it's important that we recognize this and recall it.
I think that's terribly important. I really am grateful that you bring that point up, Mark. I mean, Jim very kindly mentioned that I wrote a book very recently called China's War with Japan, but actually the North American version of the book has a different title. It's called Forgotten Allies, simply because I wanted to make the point that it's about China in World War II, and China remains the allied power between the British Empire, the United States, and the Soviet Union that we tend to forget about. And yet, to just give one specific example, if some 750,000 Japanese troops had not been held down in China during those years, then they could have been diverted elsewhere to the Pacific or else even to attack the Soviet Union or British India. And therefore, I think the fate of Asia as a whole and the fate of the Japanese Empire would have been different for a whole variety of reasons.
How did the war end? I've been taking issue, not alone, but with some other historians who follow this closely, with the American favored narrative. Indeed, Japan did surrender within days of the atomic bomb, first at Hiroshima and then on August 9th at Nagasaki. But the other part of the end of the war that I think is crucial, and we haven't talked about it yet today, so let's talk about it, is the Soviet role in that war. As a result of the agreement at Yalta, and then again Potsdam, the Soviet Union, at American and British request, agreed to enter the war against Japan within 90 days of the surrender of Germany. So the United States dropped the atomic bomb on August 6th. On August 9th or August 8th, depending on where you are in the world, Soviet forces entered the war in Manchuria against Japan. In my view, we can only understand the end of the war by putting those two events together. And in my own assessment of them, the Soviet entry probably is the more important one, given the fact that Hirohito and his advisors, the Japanese military, had more or less been unmoved by the destruction of Japan's cities in the preceding 6 months, beginning March 9th, 1945. I would argue that their crucial decision was looking over their shoulder at what an occupation by the Soviet Union would be for them.
I mean, I think those are immensely important points, and putting them together as you have done, the Soviet entry into the war in what turns out, in fact, to be the very last weeks of the war, of course, at that point it wasn't clear that it was going to end so suddenly with the atomic bombings, comes together with the bombs themselves. That said, I think I would say that, for good or ill, the fact that the war ended so quickly because of these things coming together and the atomic bombs, I think, clearly play a part in that, does a great deal to fix the shape of Asia in the immediate post-war period. Because it seems to me that China had become so weak, largely because of its insistence on resisting both nationalist and communist over the 8 years that led up to that 1945 period, that actually sustained resistance beyond that point would have been really difficult. And we should still remember that although they were cut off from supply lines up in Manchuria and Korea, there were still very large numbers of Japanese troops, hundreds of thousands, in China in the middle of 1945. That conference that you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, the Yalta conference between Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, even though in a sense it was an example yet again of big powers deciding to carve up territories, led to a settled agreement that, with some real tensions during the Cold War, nonetheless did last for the best part of half a century. And I think the key issue is that no such conference, no such agreement ever really emerged in Asia. There was no Asian Yalta as such. Mm. And as a result, the debates that are happening today in the region in some ways still go back to those wartime years.
Some observers say relations between China and Japan are their worst level in decades because of these conflicts over the East China Sea. Do you agree with that?
Relations, I think, today between China and Japan are bad. But as someone who, of course, has written a book about a real war breaking out between China and Japan in the 1930s, they're nothing like as bad as that period. So I think we have to put things in perspective. It seems to me that if we're looking for one fundamental reason why the relationship is in such a bad state at the moment, it's because of a shared inability to perceive that past history in the present in the same way. And as Mark was saying, that's very different from what's happened, say, in France and Germany, where there's essentially a mutually agreed history. On the Japan side, I would agree with Mark that there are significant parts of Japan's political establishment, including some people who are in power now, who are far too careless, who are far too blasé about the horrific atrocities that Japan committed in Asia in the past. I would add that there are very significant parts of Japan's public sphere, including academics, teachers, trade unions, left-wing newspapers, liberal newspapers, which do repeatedly point out to the Japanese people that there was this wartime record of which they should be ashamed and which they should have apologize for. So opinions in Japan are not monolithic. The problem is, and this is part of the question of why relations are so bad now, that in China, that view, that kind of variation in Japanese viewpoints is not transmitted through media and in wider propaganda. There's a very widespread perception whenever I go to China that all Japanese people deny the war, that the whole of Japan's public sphere refuses to acknowledge what happened during those wartime years. And therefore, until the two sides actually have a more genuine understanding of how each other side sees the question, I think it's going to be very hard to resolve the often rather distorted historical basis on which these present-day political claims are being made.
Rana Mitter, professor of the history and politics of modern China at Oxford University, and Mark Selden, senior research associate in the East Asia program at Cornell University and professor emeritus at Binghamton University.
It occurs to me we have not been formally introduced. A formal introduction is at hand. I am Mark from Mark.
Nanu, nanu.
That, of course, is comedian and actor Robin Williams from one of his earliest roles, Mork and Mindy. The 63-year-old Williams died at his California home this week. Police say the death was an apparent suicide. Williams had been treated for depression recently, as well as substance abuse in the past. He was popular in the United States and around the world, including China, many knowing him from a wide range of films, including Good Will Hunting.
I ask you about love. Probably quote me a sonnet, but you've never looked at a woman and been totally vulnerable. known someone that could level you with her eyes. Feeling like God put an angel on earth just for you.
VOA Mandarin Service intern Cindy joins us now to talk about the star's popularity in China.
Hi, James.
We understand that you were a big Robin Williams fan in mainland China, and a lot of your friends knew him too, so the news was rather shocking.
These few days I can tell that when I go on my microblog, when I log in my WeChat or something, it was all about Williams. So I was kind of surprised at how people want to remember him and love his movies. He was very big in China, Robin Williams.
Did you have a favorite Robin Williams movie that you saw?
So my favorite one is Good Will Hunting. I think this one is also among the favorite of most of my friends, because these few days I saw a lot of my friends, they just, I mean, quoting the lines from the movie and begin to retweet them in microblog.
What are some of the comments that you've seen on Weibo since Robin Williams' death?
A lot of my friends said that they cannot understand how such a funny guy, like, suffered from depression and melancholia. And yeah, I think his death just also lead us to think a lot about how we can cope with this kind of depression pressure in this modern world. I mean, a lot of people are under pressure, but we just cannot understand he who appears so funny and always so optimistic on the screen can suffer from that kind of disease. I mean, it's just so shocking.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Wrong speed. We've got it on the wrong speed. For those of you who are recovering from a hangover, that's going to sound just right.
Robin Williams from the movie Good Morning Vietnam, the 63-year-old actor committing suicide apparently this week, and a great loss for all who enjoyed his work.
Well, there comes a time when they have to lead their own life. Or die their own death.
And now your friend is gone forever?
Oh, no, sir. No. I'll always keep right here. Till next week, sir. I know.
Well, Jim, it seems like just about everybody is on Facebook these days, including China's president, Xi Jinping. But Facebook is officially banned in China.
Well, the China Media Project, part of the Journalism and Media Studies Center at the University of Hong Kong, reported this week that Mr. Xi's presence on Facebook was noted by a netizen on Sina Weibo.
The Post said, is President Xi now climbing the firewall? If you can access Facebook, why is it that the rest of the people inside China can't?
It may have been a matter of time before they noticed this. The posting continued, saying, if you're on Facebook, a lot of fellow students will also want to get on. So why don't you list restrictions? You must know the logic that the more you prohibit something, the more irresistible it will be, right? I hope the venerable Mr. Xi opens up the internet very quickly.
Well, now that post was later deleted on Sina Weibo.
What is the internet search engine Google's responsibility for its autocomplete tool?
A Hong Kong court has ruled that Albert Yung Sha-sheng, chairman of the Emperor Group conglomerate, is entitled to sue Google for defamation because autocomplete suggests linking him to organized crime.
Wow, I wonder what it says about the rest of us. For its part, Google said it doesn't publish the autocomplete suggestions and is merely a passive facilitator. But a high court judge said that Google is taking information from users and then publishing them as suggestions.
Google is under pressure to edit its search results in parts of the world.
Well, lest you think Chinese investors are all work and no play, that's not always the case. With growing Chinese investment in companies based in California's Silicon Valley, the American Center for High Technology is playing host to visiting Chinese business people. They're invited to a range of activities during the summer summit.
Attendees can participate in wine tastings as well as in networking. And the influx of graduates from nearby Stanford University also adds to the mix. It sounds like a good and potentially profitable time.
I'll toast to that. Well, if you'd like to toast to something, you can write to us. Our email address is voaasia@voanews.com. And, of course, we're on social media, including Weibo. But you can follow us, like President Xi Jinping, on Facebook. And we're on Twitter. Sarah's handle, @VOAWilliams. I'm @VOAStevenson. And check out our program page, voanews.com/ChinaFocus.
That's it for our show. I'm Sarah Williams.
And I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to China Focus.